Well, Keith wasn't the only one that was impressed by the state of Bert's office. we took a picture of this when we were out there at Campbell Scientific once a number of years ago, and I agree that somehow or other he was able to find whatever he needed to find there. But I thought it was particularly appropriate for the title that we came here with, because Bert knew a thing or two about messes and how to deal with them. And unlike John, I think I actually remember the first time I met Bert, and amazingly enough, I even have a picture of it. I already knew Champ at this point. I had met him at the meetings while I was a graduate student, and when I first went to Minnesota, used to go down and visit with him quite often to talk about instrumentation issues and to get him to critique my research ideas, and he was very good at that. And helped me tremendously, but in those conversations he never mentioned his kids. And then I remember, I think it was in 1988, going to a meeting out at Utah State on the measurement of plant soil water status. An excellent meeting, but included a field tour where we went up to the North Farm, and they introduced this fellow Bert Tanner from Campbell Scientific, demonstrating their state-of-the-art system for latent heat flux measurement by eddy covariance with the 1D sonic and the krypton hygrometer. And I remembered wondering at the time if this guy was related to Champ. And after hearing him describe the instrumentation in excruciating detail, and particularly after hearing him handle the questions from the audience, there was no doubt in my mind that they were related. And so I went up afterwards and introduced myself, and we got to talking, like so many of us in this room, rapidly became good, close friends, and that developed even further over the years, and with numerous trips to Logan on my part and a number of trips to Minnesota on his part, and I really value that friendship over the years. Now, what I want to talk about today is just a little device that we, Tim Griffiths, my co-author, and I have developed to use in conjunction with the tunable diode laser spectroscopy system for trace gas measurement of water vapor. And so from this point, I want to jump forward a couple of decades into the 21st century, and state-of-the-art in trace gas measurement at this point, as I mentioned, is the tunable diode laser spectroscopy system that George initially developed at Guelph, and that Bert led the commercialization of at Campbell. And we noticed by this point that Bert's hair is turning gray, and I think that these facts are intimately connected, because he poured a lot of energy into the development of this system, and went on numerous install trips around the world. And this is a trip to Minnesota where in 2001, shortly after Tim Griffiths joined our faculty and purchased one of the first carbon isotope lasers. And Bert came with Steve to help on the install at our field site at Rosemount. And that system has been very successful for us, and convinced us when they developed the water vapor isotope laser in 2008 to Tim wrote a grant to purchase one of those. Unfortunately, at that point, Bert was unable to come along on the installation trip. He was already sick, but Steve and Joel came along, and we took this group picture afterwards to send back to Bert, just to prove to him that his employees were actually working. But Shuey Lee and a couple of his friends or colleagues from Yale were here with us, and I just want to make the point here that Bert's qualities and characteristics also showed through in the people that he hired at Campbell Scientific, and Steve and Joel and all the folks that we have worked with over the years on some of these projects have a lot of those same characteristics of putting the science first and not worrying about selling things, but worrying about making sure that the numbers are right. Now, with respect and this is the intake, by the way, for the water vapor isotope laser, which is hidden in between a couple of rows of soybeans here behind Steve Sargent. But I guess the first question is, why measure the isotope composition of water vapor? Why are we interested in this? It relates back to the fact that the stable isotopologs of water vapor with 18O and 16O behave differently in the atmosphere because of their different molecular weights. So there's a discrimination against the heavier isotope in evaporation and discrimination against the lighter isotope in condensation. And these facts can be taken advantage of to provide constraints on the source origin of atmospheric moisture and to examine the condensation history of air masses and the sources of boundary layer water vapor. If you know something about the isotope fraction of soil water and of leaf water and the fractionation factors within the leaf, they allow you to partition evapotranspiration into its component fluxes. And finally, they provide a crucial link to the carbon balance through the oxygen isotope in CO2. But one of the challenges with these systems is convincing yourself that they're working properly. And the most convenient way to do that is through examining the Rayleigh distillation process. If you have a source of dry air that you're bubbling through a container of water of known isotope ratio, and you're using the TGA to monitor the isotope ratio of the vapor phase, over time it should obey the Rayleigh distillation equation. And so if you sit on a system like this and monitor it for a number of hours, you should get data that look like this, where the line is the ideal equation, and the data hopefully are the ones that you're getting from your trace gas analyzer. But we didn't have any convenient way of sort of doing this routinely in the field, so Tim asked me if there was some way we could build a little mixing ratio generator that would serve our purposes for this, and I thought that should be something we could do without too much difficulty, and that it would also be useful for us as a calibrator for close-path infrared gas analyzers that we have in so many flux measurement sites around the world. June Kim and Monique both mentioned the various flux sites around the world. They're close to 500 now, primarily driven by concerns about CO2, but all of them measuring water vapor as well. And the CO2 data have received a lot more attention, and I think that's at least partly due to the fact that we have more trust in those data because we can routinely swap in calibration gases to check the performance of the instruments. And on water vapor, we don't have that option. So we thought at the same time we'd try and develop a little a unit that would be useful not only for Rayleigh distillation tests, but also to use as a virtual calibration tank for water vapor measurements in flux systems around the world. So our design criteria for this, number one, obviously, is accuracy in generating known mixing ratios and stability for Rayleigh tests. You need to maintain a stable mixing ratio for a long period of time. And for those same tests, you want a large liquid capacity and you want an easy quantitative filling and draining of it. And, you know, as always, we're looking for low power consumption and cost is a concern as well if we want to put these at multiple sites. These are the equations we're working with. They're fairly simple. That if you bubble dry air through water and you know the pressure and the temperature within the cell, the saturation vapor pressure over pure water is simply a function of temperature. Saturation vapor pressure in air, there's a slight pressure dependence as well that comes in. But the long and the short of it is that you measure pressure and temperature and you can compute the mixing ratio. And this is not new. This is the same concept that's been used in the dew point generators and other humidity calibration devices. But none of the ones that were available quite met all of our criteria, so that's why we kind of started from scratch. And this is the little device that we built. Just uses a thermoelectric cooler that's commercially available, and we took a chunk of aluminum that we had left in the lab from another project and milled out a cavity inside that's about 5 centimeters in diameter and I don't know, 7 or 8 centimeters deep, rounded at the bottom so there's no areas where stagnant water might collect, so everything is involved in mixing. And a couple of ports in the bottom that One is where the bubbler comes in. This is just a stainless steel frit, and this is connected to a dry air source. And then the other is just a lure lock fitting that's connected to a barrel syringe that allows us to easily and quantitatively fill and drain it. And this is just a copper bulb with a fine wire thermocouple in it that for monitoring temperature. There's a T-fitting at the top with one lead that leads off to a pressure transducer, and then the other goes to some sort of flow controller, either a rotometer or a mass flow controller. This is all encompassed in styrofoam to give us temperature stability. And the whole thing is operated with a 23X data logger that measures temperature and pressure and computes the mixing ratio and compares it to your set point mixing ratio, and then adjusts the polarity and duty cycle of 12-volt power source to the thermoelectric cooler to drive the chamber to the correct mixing ratio. And to see how well it worked, we just did a calibration test where we compared it at six different mixing ratios to measured the outflow with the Licor 6262 gas analyzer, and at each step we separately calibrated the gas analyzer against the dew point generator, and got virtually identical results. So this is essentially a check of the mixing ratio generator against the dew point generator, and mean absolute error of about 0.07 millimole per mole. And you know, in a system like this, you can either control temperature, or you can control pressure, or you can control both. We tried controlling both at first, but the control systems end up kind of fighting with one another, and you're better off just measuring one and controlling the other. So we let pressure float, and then the system adjusts the temperature to maintain a constant mixing ratio. So this is over a 14-hour period, sort of what we would do a Rayleigh test over. And you see the temperature being ramped upward to match the change in pressure. And this is the mixing ratio that results over that same time period. So it's the design set point was 14 millimole per mole, and you know, we're essentially sitting right on there with no drift to speak of, and a noise level in the neighborhood of 3.5 parts per million. And we'd like to get this down a little bit better. There's still some things I think we can improve, but generally speaking, I think we've got something that will work for us. And so in conclusion, this is where we're at with the system, and we'd like to get both the accuracy and the noise level a little bit better. Power consumption is pretty reasonable, about 10 watts or so, and large liquid capacity, so we can run this for a long period of time if we need to. And cost-wise, the thermoelectric cooler is about $170. Most everything else we had around the lab, but if you had to buy a pressure transducer, it'd be about $600. And shop time depends on, you know, that's going to vary from place to place, but roughly I think most people could build this for about $1,000 or so. And so that's pretty much what I wanted to say with respect to that. And I just want to close with this picture from a trip that we took in 2001, and that's my co-author Tim Griffiths there in the center, and this was when we went out to learn about the operation of the carbon isotope laser, and we spent 2 or 3 days working dawn to dusk in the lab with Steve Sargent learning all about alignment and defocusing and finding lines and all the intricacies of operating the instrument. And Bert came in at the end of the day on Friday, and he said, we've been working too hard. And he said, we got to get out of the office tomorrow morning. So on Saturday morning, we picked up Joel and headed up to Green Canyon and hiked over to Tony Grove Lake. And at a water break along the way, I snapped this picture, and this is just, I don't know, one of many memories I have of our interactions with Bert over the years, but it's one of my favorites. As Keith spoke earlier, he believed in working really hard, but he also believed in taking time to have fun and get outside as well. And just one of many lessons I think I learned from him, and I just want to express my appreciation to Bruce for letting me take part in this symposium to recognize Bert and his many contributions to all of us. Thanks.
We are just coming up on noon. Could we? Somebody turn the lights up in the back? One of the speakers official in the program is missing in the program, but I've asked Galen Campbell if he would like to say a few remembrances about Bert. Decagon has helped us financially with this, and we're over time a bit, but I still want to take time to hear from Galen. You don't have any slides in here, do you? Yeah.
Extemporaneous.
Appreciate the chance to say just a couple of things, mostly say amen to the things that have been said here. I don't remember when I first met Bert, but I know when I first got acquainted with him, it was more over the phone than in person, I guess. He actually had intended to come to Pullman and be a graduate student with me. And he and Cookie decided they'd take one last hike in the Grand Canyon before they moved to Pullman. In a camping accident, Cookie got their foot burned, and they went to the burn center in Salt Lake. Bert was kicking around there with nothing to do. He called me up and said we'd be a little bit late getting to Pullman. I said, well, while you're around there, why don't you go up to Logan and talk to my brothers? They've just started a little thing up there. You might be interested in what they're doing. And the rest is history, I guess. He never showed up in Pullman for some reason. I can't help but think back 21 years to the symposium like this one. I think it might have been the first symposium that ASA ever had honoring the career of an individual, and that person was Bert's father. Both Bert and his father have had enormous influence on my life, and I need to express my thanks for that influence. Maybe I could end with just one quick story that I think illustrates Bert better than any that I know of. Bert's dedication to science. Eddy covariance is a pretty popular thing now, but when Bert started into it, it was not such a well-known or popular thing. Back in the late 70s, Ed Weeks came to him and said, I'd like you to help us out doing some measurements of evapotranspiration along the Pecos River in New Mexico. We'd like you to build some equipment and help out in that. Well, it's been alluded to that Bert was an unusual vice president for marketing. He said, no, we won't sell you that stuff. So Ed, I think, got on his knees and said, we need it. Please, won't you sell us this equipment? We were just in the early stages of experimenting with the things that John Baker showed, the equipment John Baker showed, and we had some kind of prototypes then. And so Bert finally agreed that he would sell the equipment and go and help out with the experiment. So I went on a couple of those campaigns, and we went down and measured evapotranspiration on salt cedar with some of the early 1D sonics and krypton hygrometers. And I wasn't along for the one that's alluded to here, but on one of those, overnight, a turkey buzzard who had been into some particularly ripe carrion had perched on the top of the sonic anemometer and krypton hygrometer and just crapped all over the whole thing. Bert was not happy to find that the next morning, but his dedication to science overcame his whatever other inclinations. He took that back and scrubbed it all off, got it working again, and put it back out to collect more data. Well, I surely will miss Bert, as has been expressed here. He's been a good friend for many, many years. I've appreciated that chance and appreciate being here to experience this.